You're listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 288. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. This is Adam White recording for you after a long, I'm sure, excruciating absence to everyone from the show. Recording for you from my basement here in Niagara Falls, Ontario, in a cloud of disgusting child germs. And joining me in quarantine here tonight on the show from Philadelphia, which is really a quarantine zone in and of itself. Mr. John Gentile.
Let me tell you, if you want to go to a quarantine area, you go to any Philadelphia bar on a Friday or Saturday night. It is a lot of sick people, if you will, and a lot of people that don't have a lot left to lose. Let me tell you, that's Philadelphia for you.
And then a Grand Rapids, Michigan, Mr. Tom Trauma.
What's up, guys?
So what happened here last week?
I was here. Let me get to the mail real quick. This is, as always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. We love getting your mail. This is from Steve. Steve said, "Where was Adam? I missed him on the podcast this week." This is from Frank. Frank said, "I want Adam White back on the podcast."
This is all lies.
This is from Gwendolyn. "The podcast is not the same without Adam White."
You're just making names up.
This is from Jones. Jones says, "Please bring back Adam. He is the best."
There's no one in the real world named Gwendolyn.
This is from yes, there is.
Not that has a computer, at least.
This is from Ash, and Ash said, "Where's Adam? Please bring him on more often."
Now you're getting off of like names.
This is from Herbert. Herbert,
please bring him on more often. He's literally on 99% of the time.
I didn't write the emails. This is Herbert. Herbert says, "I can't stand a week missing Adam again. Bring him back on." And this is from Ortiz. Ortiz said, "Donde está la señor Adam?" So there you go, have it, Adam. The people have demanded you on the Punk News Podcast.
Well, I mean, if the Spaniards are looking for me, I guess I should, you know, show up more often. So yeah, hi. My kids are all sick and gross, and we have a sick 3-year-old and a sick like 8-month-old at the same time, and that's not fun because they just one will get all coughing and disgusting and wake the other one up, and then they both decide that they don't want to sleep, but they don't want to sleep on schedules that mean we don't actually sleep. So I'm just in a fog. It's been like I've like emerged from the jungle after a long firefight, and you know, my senses are all shot, and I don't even know which side of the war I'm on anymore. But here I am. So,
Adam, do you think you're impervious to all germs now? Are you now completely invincible to germs because you've been exposed to so many?
No, I'm probably barely hanging on to, you know, my own health and sanity right now. This is probably my weakest point. I have to imagine. I guess it only gets worse when they like start going to school and are exposed to like other disgusting children, and they just all they melt into some sort of like collective super animal that I can't handle. That's what I'm thinking is happening. So I'm not entirely looking forward to this, but I assume that, you know, at the other end of it, I mean, I can't even say it's going to make me stronger, because at the other end of it, I'm going to be old. So at that point, my it's like there's just no hope.
It's covered with like a thin layer of mucus that will protect you. You'll be all right.
Adam, so anyways, yeah. Do we have real mail?
That was the real mail.
Oh, good. All right. So we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff this week. This is kind of a funny week in that there was not anything that I think outside of two stories are particularly noteworthy, and then even those stories are not particularly huge conversation starters in my end. So you know, if everyone wants to go, you know, catch up on Serial or something, then maybe this is the week to do it. But let's talk about some stuff that has happened this week. First of all, and this is not news, but I thought I wanted to mention this because it totally fucked me up today when I heard it. John, I know you're not a fan of digital music at all, but for some of us, that's how we've had to get by for, you know, for some lean years here. So I realized today that the only copy I've ever owned of Fucked Up's The Chemistry of Common Life has always ever been one that I had as MP3s. And I was trying to figure out where these would have come from, because that record's a few years old, but I'm thinking it must have been from eMusic. I used to be an eMusic subscriber at the time, before they went under. God bless them. And eMusic had this deal where you could get, you know, it was like 50 downloads a month or something, and then they would reset the 50 every month. And when you really worked it out, it was super cheap, and it was actually downloads. It wasn't streaming. But anyways, I think that must have been where I got my copy of Chemistry. And I was in, now eMusic is no longer, I don't even know if they're around, but they're no longer a part of my life. And I was in iTunes today looking at records that I was listening to while I was at my office. And I pull up Chemistry of Common Life, and there's one song that is in the middle of the record that has a little cloud next to it where iTunes is telling me, you haven't downloaded this in particular song. Like, you have all of the others, but you don't have this song. And the song is called The Peaceable Kingdom. And I realized the entire time I've owned this record, digitally at least, I've been missing like the one track in the middle of the record. And I was unaware of this. And then I was listening to it through and I hit this song and I'm like, what? I'm like, I've heard this record 6 million times. What is this? And all of a sudden there's this song that I've never heard in the middle of the record. And I cannot think of when that has happened to me before.
An
album that you are otherwise intimately familiar with, but you're too dumb to realize that you have been missing a song from the middle of that record for the years that you have been listening to that record. It's not like it's a B-side or something like that. Like, it's an album track. I don't know what to believe anymore. My whole belief system has been shattered by this.
Physical never lies, baby.
It's like the casualty of never having listened to it on physical. That's right.
10 years later, yeah. 20 years later, that CD still has those jams. By contrast, if your hard drives crash, or if you're an idiot and you lose your iPod like I did yesterday, then you lose all those jams. Physical, baby.
So, John.
Yes,
can
Adam. You hear me? Yes, Adam.
I've got all kinds of crazy robot stuff happening here. This is the wonders of doing something over Skype. But let's talk about some of the stories that actually happened this week. The first one, this seemed to get everybody talking, although I don't really know if they're talking just because it's some noteworthy bands or because there's actually something people are looking forward to here. But members of No Doubt and AFI have formed a quote-unquote supergroup. So three members of No Doubt, the non-Gwen members of No Doubt in particular, Tom Dumont, Tony Candle, and Adrian Young, they have formed a new band alongside AFI frontman Davey Havoc. The band has apparently recorded a full album, and they're shopping it around the labels. The band doesn't have a name yet, and you know, no one knows what this sounds like. There's been no indication of whether this is more of a No Doubt-y sounding band or more of an AFI sounding band, and if so, what era of AFI. But this thing exists, so this group is out shopping stuff around. I mean, on the other hand, you know, Gwen's set to release her third new solo record. Third, really?
Third.
The
first one is Lamb. The second is The Sweet Escape. And this third one will be called This Is What the Truth Feels Like.
I feel like I'm completely out of the Gwen Stefani pipeline. So there you go. I didn't know that. But anyways, yes, that's coming out on March 18th if you want to tune into that. But this new AFI No Doubt Grid Monster group here it exists. It's doing something. Is this something that that interests you? Like, is this something that you would be, that you, you know, when you hear that combination, are looking forward to? Those aren't even two bands that I would like put in the same sentence, because that they just seem to be from different universes. But yeah, John, does this tickle your fancy?
Well, I actually think the connection makes a lot of sense, because both, I mean, No Doubt started out as a punk band in the small L.A. punk scene or Orange County punk scene. AFI started out as a small punk band in the Gilman Street scene, you know? I mean, in a respect, it sort of does make sense, because No Doubt started out in the late 80s, mid 80s OC punk scene, and No Doubt did start out as a punk band for sure, or a ska punk band. And AFI started out as a punk band in the Gilman Street scene, late 80s, early 90s. So I think AFI is a little bit younger than No Doubt. So I mean, that the connection makes sense there. And plus, both bands started out as punk bands or ska punk bands, and then eventually sort of became gigantic or semi. I guess No Doubt's a lot bigger than AFI, but AFI is pretty big. I mean, AFI is major label; they're in the major publications, and they both became wildly successful acts and kind of went more towards traditional pop, not traditional pop, modern pop music. I mean, the last No Doubt album was a pop album, and AFI is, I guess, kind of goth pop, maybe you could call it that. So I think the connection makes a lot of sense. Am I interested in this? The answer is no, not at all. People love AFI. I have listened to all eras of AFI. I am just not into AFI. It's too pretty sounding, I guess. It's too, like, I know they've got some early horror punk lyrics and that kind of stuff, but it's just too clean and too bright sounding. It doesn't have any of the nastiness or backbone for me. So I'm just, I mean, basically, No Doubt without – I mean, the guys in No Doubt are really good musicians, and they've written some incredible songs. But No Doubt without Gwen Stefani, I'm just not interested in it at all, you know. I'm more interested in Gwen's solo album. I think her first solo album was basically the best pop album ever. I mean, it's basically doing what Madonna did, but kind of better if you ask me. I think her second album was okay. I don't know if this one's going to be that good or not. What really surprised me, though, is I think No Doubt is kind of – painted as a band where they're all friends. You know, some bands, like the guys in the band, are all friends, and some they kind of hate each other. Like, Tom, you know, in Slayer, it's pretty clear that everybody in Slayer, it's purely a business relationship, and they might even dislike each other. You know, like the way they talk.
The Ramones model.
Well, the Ramones model, I think, is a little different, because the Ramones model is they dislike each other, but they're sort of family because they've been around each other so long. So they do dislike each other, but there's a certain closeness to that, even though they dislike each other. And who knows if they really, really dislike each other. But it's like Tom Araya and Jeff and Kerry King, I think they have nothing in common anymore. And I think it's purely business, you know. I think they sort of annoy each other. By contrast, like No Doubt, they're usually painted as a bunch of friends that still know each other, you know, that still regularly hang out. But as it turns out, Gwen Stefani learned about this new band when the rest of us learned about the new band via the internet. So the question is, has No Doubt irreparably broken down? Is No Doubt completely over? Is there no communication between them at all?
I think it's weird for a band when you are in your – I don't think – what are they? They must be in their 40s, right?
45.
Yeah. Well, when you're a career musician that have been in bands your entire life, you've had some success, so you don't need to be on the road all the time. Your band is still, you know, it's still a functioning musical act, but it's not a commune that you live in anymore, right? Like the No Doubt people aren't driving around the country in a van 200 days out of the year. I don't know if they ever did, but anymore for sure, right? What must they play, you know, these days? A handful of festival appearances or something like that every year?
They play very big shows.
Yeah, and they're an arena. Yeah, they're an arena band if they tour.
But they're generally, at least as far as I've, you know, my perception of it, is they're not even doing huge tours at this point. So these are people that they've had enough kind of like pop culture presence that they could legitimately just go away for like 2.5 years. And no one would question it. I mean, bands take, you know, bands can take like 4, 5, 6 years between albums, that, you know, these days anyways. So it wouldn't really be a huge stretch for for, you know, someone to come and say, oh, the Dodo people haven't spoken to each other in like 2-3 years. And that, you know, that's totally the kind of thing that could happen. So, yeah, I could absolutely see, especially someone like her that is in her own right, someone with a musical career that doesn't involve the rest of them, you know, just learns about something like this now.
It could be, yeah, the three of them and her. That could be the, you know what I mean? It could be the three of them are still good friends and she's not. But she probably makes more money solo than with the band. She's probably bigger as a solo artist than the band, don't you think?
Well, almost guaranteed, especially because, I mean, I don't know if they've got an equal split between the band, but I'm sure it's not 100% Gwen, 0% the guy.
But even if Gwen put out a new album and No Doubt put out a new album, Gwen sells more copies than No Doubt.
You might be right. Or
am I wrong about that?
You might be right. If it's Gwen doing pop music, which she does solo, you're probably right, because that gets play, like not only on the radio, but in commercials, at sports stadiums, that kind of a thing, you know? So you're probably right.
As far as this band goes, me personally, I couldn't care less. As a matter of fact, I couldn't care less if Gwen Stefani started playing with the remaining members of AFI. It's just, yeah, it doesn't do anything for me. That's to play the antagonist, as I love to do.
I have a feeling that this is probably going to sound much older than people... than people might take, because I think a lot of people read this and their brains are immediately jumped to, you know, the era of AFI that everybody loves, and then the era of No Doubt that everyone will admit to loving. People are thinking about, like, wow, we're gonna have this like crazy like Tragic Kingdom Black Sails in the Sunset mashup or something like that, and it's like none of these bands have sounded like that in 20 years at this point. Like all of all these guys are old. This could end up being something that is completely, you know, despite the pedigree of the people involved, you know, completely off the wall different. And knowing the kind of weird solo shit that Davey Havok seems to get involved in, it's probably like a fucking electronic album.
Well, and isn't, I mean, No Doubt's music is sort of like happy, and isn't Davey Havok sort of sad? He looks sort of sad.
Oh, whoever's folding paper, you're making sorry, too much me. Paper foldy I'm noises done. On the podcast, and people are pissed right now. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if Davey Havok is legitimately sad anymore. I imagine that he's probably pretty content with his life and career. But
I hope so. I hope he's found peace.
I don't know how long you can maintain that unless you're like Robert Smith or something. But anyway, so that's the thing. A lot of people talked about this, but, you know, who knows what it's actually going to sound like. We're going to talk about a story now that Tom... I think this is one of your bands here, is it not? The Lippies.
It is.
And, yeah, the Lippies had a video called for the song As We Fall that premiered over on Noisy. You can go check it out. We have it linked up on Punk News. This is a song from the band's self-titled debut full-length that is going to come out on Red Scare. And is now available for pre-order, and you can find links to all that stuff on Punk News. So, Tom, like, what did you think about this? This is right up your...
I'm sort of sad about this because they did an open call when they shot this video, and I was going to go with my older daughter, but I had some adult stuff I had to attend to, unfortunately, so I missed it. But it was shot here at a local skate park, and it's a pretty fun video, and I certainly recognize a lot of the faces in the crowd.
For some reason, when you said adult stuff, I just pictured your daughter being like, Dad, let's go to the music video thing. And you're like, I can't. I have to do my taxes. That's adult stuff in my head.
I have many, many females in my life that I need to keep happy. It's a delicate balancing act.
So you do recognize like a lot of scene people in this then?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That always fascinates me whenever I see one of these videos that shows up that is like folks from, you know, from my immediate vicinity. Like there's definitely like early like Alexis on Fire or Pup or Dirty Nil videos and stuff like that where I can watch them and then they're like full of people that I see at shows.
Oh, I thought you were gonna say you could pick yourself out, because I would have been the big guy like standing in the middle of the room drinking a tall boy, but no, I had to do something else that day. So
I love those old hardcore documentaries where they'll have like just an old Polaroid and it just like a bunch of generic looking people in a photo, and then like somebody like Keith Morris or Mike Watt or whoever was like, oh, that's Steve, you know, Steve McFree, and that's, you know, Bill Jones, and like they just pick out every single person in the photo, and then like the scene was so small that you knew everybody at the show, you know.
There's a Poison Idea has been real active lately, John. We kind of talked about this a little bit. They're doing a little East Coast jaunt.
Yeah, I just saw them.
They've been posting a bunch of photos, and it's all these old photos of all these old hardcore bands. And Adam, the singer for, or I'm sorry, Jerry A, right? That's the singer.
Jerry A
Jerry A. There's like all these photos of him in the front row. Like his face with all these famous classic 80s hardcore bands playing. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool stuff. Worth looking at.
Hey, well, speaking of classic hardcore bands, Green Day.
Excellent segue.
A fan has released a YouTube mashup video of the song Basket Case. What they did was take 109 movies, about two or three words from each movie, and then strung together and made a clip version of the Green Day's classic song "Basket Case." Adam White, is this worth the time that the person put into it? How long do you think the person put into it? And is this clever art, or is this just unnecessary regurgitation, which we see over and over and over now in the postmodern world, particularly the postmodern art world?
I am troubled by this thing.
Troubled? You don't say.
Troubled. I'm troubled. Because on the one hand, I am all for people using the internet to waste all their time making all kinds of goofy-ass art projects. And like I'm all for that, and I want to discourage anyone from doing that. But this, as I was watching this, I wasn't struck by how clever it was. I was just sort of struck by
how much work it was.
I was half a minute into this, and I'm thinking that like this took someone a long time, and I don't know if the payoff is worth it. You know, like it's definitely a testament to this dude's like, I don't know, like video editing and maybe like content sourcing skills to put this thing together. And there's a few, you know, the most interesting and fun little parts of this are actually when there isn't lyric stuff happening, but when they'll like flip over to a, you know, footage of someone playing a guitar, and they'll flip over to like Marty McFly playing guitar on stage in Back to the Future at a part where there's a guitar solo in Basket Case. So there's little bits like that that are kind of fun, but I, you know, when they're in the middle of the verse and they're just flipping between, you know, 25 different movies and people saying like one word out of each movie, I'm looking at that and going, that took a lot of time to put together, but doesn't feel like I'm super enriched by having watched it.
Did you make it all the way through it?
Some child may have barfed on me halfway through.
I confess, I could not. I'm just like, after 1 minute, I'm like, I'm not going to watch two more minutes of this.
That may have been it. It was just,
I wasn't lucky enough to have someone puke on me to get it over, you know, to cause my break. I just walked away.
I don't know. I mean, John, you're all about the whimsy. Does this fall in the whimsy category?
Well, I do wonder if you guys are hitting. I mean, I thought it was whimsical and amusing, although the joke is over after 30 seconds. It's like, I get it.
That's it. It is. It's cool, but it's just like,
Here's my question is, you know, there's Tumblr and all this, like how many Star Wars parody memes and shirts and all, you know, are there? How many Black Flag memes are there and shirts are there? How many Ramon memes and shirts are there? Do you think that we have such a, do you think that our cup runneth over so much that it comes at the cost of creating new art? Like, because it's so easy to do mashups and source stuff and reference stuff now, do you think that had that not been accessible, there'd be more original art? Or do you think the amount of original art is basically the same?
I have a strong opinion about this.
Do tell.
Only because you can see the amount of stuff that we as like the internet, I guess, are generating just by like if you have a YouTube account and you log into it and you just look at the stuff that YouTube recommends to you based on other content that you've watched before. And for me, I don't feel like I watch a lot of that mashup-y stuff, but that's all that I see that it's recommending to me. And I don't mean like little video mashups like this, but I mean like regurgitations of pop culture stuff. So, you know, I'm just going to just do it live here. Or like at some point I had watched, you know, a movie review or something like that. And because of watching someone's movie review, all my recommendations are here's 10 crazy ideas dropped from The Force Awakens, right? And it's like stuff like that. The top 10 fuck ups in video game history. All this shit, right? Like where it's, you know, it's people's interaction with culture rather than people's creation of culture. It's not people creating art necessarily, but so much as people reacting to art or you know, commentating on art. And I mean, I don't want to stop anyone from doing that because, like, fuck, we're punk news. That's what we do, is we talk about, you know, art that we didn't make. So, you know, all the power to you if you're going to do that. But at least the way that it's being filtered and presented to me feels overwhelming. Like, I never log into YouTube and I see, you know, here's 30 different original things that may interest you based on whatever. It's you come in and it's like, oh, hey, you watched someone's, you know, Star Wars review. Do you want to see, you know, some dickbag's theory about, you know, why Darth Vader's mask is black? And it's like, no, I don't. But there's 17 of those videos, right? And like the I don't know if it's reviews culture or reaction culture, this reinterpretation of content that people are familiar with and then, you know, spitting it back out onto YouTube is kind of astonishing just in the volume of it. There's so much. And on the one hand, is that stuff, I don't know if that's necessarily taking away from people's ability to go make new and creative and original things, but from my perspective as an information consumer, it definitely seems to be drowning it out.
Well, actually, in a way, we're almost creating like a cultural hegemony. You guys like that? Do I sound smart by saying that? A cultural hegemony of the top few select artistic works. Like, if you just do a completely unoriginal Star Wars meme, like, you know, like on a picture of Darth Vader and it says, I hate my dad. Like, people will share that literally a million times on the internet. But if you record a song and put it up there, maybe you'll get 300 plays, you know? And now, of course, Star Wars the movie is more interesting than probably just some schmuck's original song. But is some cheesy, like, it's almost symbolism devolved to its most basest state, in that when we're sharing these stupid memes or whatever, we don't even really think that meme is that interesting. We're just saying, I like Star Wars, I like Black Flag. And I do kind of think that is coming at a cost of original stuff. So it's almost like if you're at the very top of popularity or art-wise, then you get all the benefits where everyone else kind of just gets drowned away, and I think that's unfortunate. So I don't see an end to it. I mean, who's the most famous guy on YouTube? That PewDiePie guy? And all he does is like yell shit over like playing video games. You know what I mean? So like, I don't know, man. Well,
we're kind of a flyby culture too. In other words, you can look at that meme and laugh for literally 5 seconds and move on, as opposed to taking 3 minutes to listen to a song. You know, I just think nobody's got any attention span. We're not willing to put any effort into our own enjoyment. It has to be instantaneous. It's just we're sort of an instant gratification culture.
I agree 100%, but I do feel as though maybe we're coming off as too old on this. So let me do the counterpoint. The meme culture encourages spontaneous creativity, spontaneous whimsy, spontaneous wackiness. So maybe the
as long as you can borrow half of it from someone else.
Well, very, very true. But to be fair, the idea of art as a sacred thing that cannot be touched by anyone else is only about 100 years old. I mean, if you go back to songs from the 1800s, pretty much every single song is a ripoff of a song from before it, and it's somehow changed. Like, look at Junko Partner by The Clash. That song's 200 years old or 150 years old. It just got stolen by some guy, got stolen by somebody else, and it grew as it went along. Let's look at Shakespeare stuff. Shakespeare's the man. Most of his stuff is sourced from Greek sources, Roman sources, and other sources as well. Let's look at all all the medieval plays where they would have like Punch and Judy, and that, like, those are all stock characters that get used and reused time and time again. If you want to think about it, Punch and Judy are the first meme. So the idea of art as a sacred thing that should not be replicated by anybody else except for the artist is really only 100 years old. And I back that concept, mind you, but I think we're seeing a dissolution of that idea, and maybe that's how it's going to be for the next long time, you know?
I think one of the big things that hasn't really been sorted out with this whole with the YouTube culture, I guess, is we're all still and by we, I'm including myself as a consumer and the people that are making this stuff as well. We're all still victim is not the right word. We are at the mercy of how YouTube or really Facebook or anything that we're consuming media on, how it's choosing to parse and present this stuff to us. So I've listened to a lot of punk rock related stuff on YouTube, as you can imagine. But when I log into YouTube, it's not giving me, I mean, there's a few, but it's usually not telling me like, here's all this crazy punk rock stuff that's out there. And I assume it is out there. There may very well be people making really compelling, you know, commentary about punk music, say, and putting it on YouTube somewhere. But that's not what I see. I go on there and I see, like right now, I see like 600 things about fucking Deadpool. Is that because that is that's just the collective bulk of what humanity is creating videos about right now is Deadpool? Or is it that that's what, you know, YouTube's recommendation robot has decided that I need to care about? And I think it's probably more that. And this is the struggle. This is the struggle that everyone that has these online services are trying to work on right now. And I mean, Apple is an interesting one in this standpoint, because one of the things that came out when they announced Apple Music was that they announced that, oh, it's not only is it, you know, some streaming service, but we are actually going to have like some humans that curate some radio stations on it. And they made it sound like that was a big deal. And they got a lot of people made fun of them for it. We're like, oh, Apple invented a radio station. Like, good for them. Like, we haven't had those before. But in the internet context, actually having someone in there that is like a human being that is curating and DJing this stuff out to you, basically, is partly what's missing. At least that feels like what is missing with YouTube for me. Like, I don't look at YouTube and feel like, wow, there's this bulk of a video that I could be consuming about all topics of the world. No, I pull it up and I see like, oh great, there's 600 fucking videos here about, you know, the latest movie, and, you know, some people regurgitating, you know, the top 10 blah 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 video game list shit, and right, and I look at it and I go like, ah. But that's not necessarily like, you know, that's not the content of YouTube. That's what the algorithm's giving me. So I think that their algorithms are probably partly to blame at our perception on this.
Well, let's fight against the system picking stuff for us automatically. Somebody play a song. Tom, Adam, play a song.
Okay. I have been fully entrenched in this sampler. There's this festival, music festival in Detroit, and it's March 3rd through 5th, and they put out this huge sampler. It's 50-plus bands. A song from each of the bands appearing, and I've been listening to this thing, and it's awesome. It's all kinds of crazy stuff, mostly heavy, mostly variations on metal, but there's some punk stuff and some just bizarre stuff, some grindcore stuff. And the band that hosts the festival is called Child Bite, and they are from Detroit, and they have a new song that they put on this comp that's on their forthcoming album, which is coming out on April Fool's Day, April 1st. And this is Child Bite, and the song is called Vermin Mentality.
We are back. It was Child Bite, Verma Mentality. And we have our other, I want to say, big story of the week. Maybe the big story of the week as far as classic punk news bands go. Bad Religion has a new drummer. And the new drummer's name is Jamie Miller. This was an odd story for us to report on because it was broken by a Chilean radio station. Bad Religion guitarist Brian Baker did an interview, and he revealed in the interview that Jamie here was the new drummer for the band, replacing Brooks Wackerman, who, as you may remember, left and went to join Avenged Sevenfold. So Jamie is now a member of the band. Bad Religion bassist Jay Bentley then went and shared a photo of him and Jamie, calling him just the new guy, out on Instagram there. But the band themselves has not actually made like a big formal announcement about this yet. It's just they're talking about it. Now, Jamie Miller, he has been in a bunch of bands that you may or may not have heard of. The most famous of them being And You Will Know Us by the Trail of Dead. He was also in a band called Snot. In both of those bands, he drummed. And then he played guitar in a band that I remember was going around a little while ago, and I assume was a punk band, I believe, called The Start. That was what was The Start? Dark Wave. The Start was a little bit more of a new wave band, but they had a few records that we had interacted with that were released on Nitro Records back in the day. Back in 2004, that era. So Jamie Miller's been around. He's played in all kinds of bands, and he is now the new guy in Bad Religion, replacing Brooks Wackerman. There you go. There's a new member there. Tom, any thoughts on this? I mean, have you heard any of his other bands?
The guy's obviously a professional drummer. I really don't know Trail of Dead's music. I know that it's not nearly as fast as Bad Religion's, but listen, the guy's a drummer. I'm sure he's very good at it. I'm sure they have a good chemistry with him. I'm a little concerned with the Snot connection. Weren't they like a really shitty nu metal band?
Yeah.
You remember those?
I don't recognize that name at all.
But that being said, these drummers, man, they're a special breed of whore. And they just jump around and, from band to band. And I'm sure the guy's great. I'm sure they get along with him great. And I'm sure he'll be great with Bad Religion. But if for some reason, it doesn't, I don't know. The drummers, whatever, don't seem to breed the loyalty that, like your singer and guitar player do. So anyway, good luck, man. I hope it's great. I'm sure it will be.
Tom, I think you just titled a Nick Cave album, A Special Breed of Whore.
I didn't even really mean it as an insult, but these drummers. They jump from band to band like a bunch of floozies.
They do. Well, listen,
I'm very tempted to title this episode that, but I don't know if it would have come across.
We've been getting beat on by the politically correct police lately. So,
speaking about a special breed of whore, Ozzy Osbourne and the rest of Black Sabbath, well, not the rest of Black Sabbath, the other half of Black Sabbath.
Three quarters of Black Sabbath.
We'll be playing Hellfest. And as you know, Black Sabbath has announced their final tour. It's called The End. But they keep extending it. The end keeps getting drawn out. Who knows if it's really the end? This is really a question for Tom. Actually, well, Adam White, are you a Black Sabbath fan or are you just so-so?
I'm so-so. I like total respect, but they were not a band that, like, as a kid that I listened to. So as an adult, they're, you know, they're on this long list of bands that I know a lot of people that I respect are totally into Black Sabbath, but I've got, you know, kids barfing on me. So,
well, you know, I just listened to a Master of Reality last week. Man, what a great record. Anyways,
pretty good.
What I was going to say is, so Black, it's Ozzy, it's
Geezer, Tony.
And Tony. No, Bill Ward is not there. I think
I don't even know who's drumming for them at the moment. It's not the Rage Against the Machine guys.
Oh, it probably just.
I don't think so.
It might be what's his name? Jamie,
the new Bad Religion, the new Bad Religion drummer.
So anyway, so
it's Brooks Wackerman.
I'm just going to tell you, know, back I think it was 2005. I think it was 2000. Must have been 2004. I went to Ozfest. It was Slayer, Judas Priest, Black Sabbath, and they all played full sets. One of the greatest concerts ever. All bands were in their prime. That was kind of like the last year when Slayer was still Slayer. And, you know, Priest was back with Halford. They were amazing. Black Sabbath had recently they reunited in 98, but this was the second reunion. And Ozzy was still in good health then, and they were great. Since then, I've gotten lots of reports that Ozzy just does not have the goods anymore. Tom Trauma, I know a lot of people are saying, well, I want to see Sabbath one last time or the first time at all. Even if Bill Ward's not there, I still want to see the best, at least a part of Sabbath if I can, before they hang it up. Is Sabbath worth seeing if you haven't seen them before? Is Sabbath worth seeing if you have seen them before?
They're actually playing 2 days from today, Friday. They will be done by the time you guys hear this, but they are playing in Detroit. And I toyed with the idea of going. My older son seems to have a little bit of a penchant for classic rock, but I don't think he's got such a penchant for it that I'm going to spend like a shitload of money and drive 3 hours to see them. But much like yourself, John, I did see the original four lineup. I saw it twice, actually. And I'm sorry if I sound like that asshole who likes – I'm not trying to brag about all the various shit I see when I tell these stories. I swear. I'm just old. But I did see him twice, and it was pretty awesome. So, like, seeing a slightly – not even slightly – seeing a diminished version of them now is not really that interesting to me. I'd rather just, you know – I'd rather throw on Paranoid or Sabotage and just listen to that. You know?
Agreed 100%. I feel as though I saw them – Maybe not at their peak, but when they still had the power. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think I was barely born when they still had the power, John. I think you were not even a gleam in your father's eye yet when they were really good.
You actually bring up a good point. I actually might disagree with you on this, Tom. The reason is, let's use...
Because they were all junkies in the 70s?
Well, because they were all junked out because each gig wasn't really... It was just another gig, you know, so... Black Sabbath used to do, like, you know, 20-minute jams once in a while. And frankly, that is not – I don't know who thought that was interesting in the 70s. Like, when
that was their bell-bottom era where you look at the photos, you're like, oh, wow, afros and bell-bottoms.
Or like, when Zeppelin would do, like, 35-minute versions of their songs. Oh, it was just not interesting. But anyways, the point is this. Like you watch some old Black Flag videos, yeah, especially with Keith Morse, yeah, it's awesome. But you can tell, like, they're just – like, it's not a special gig. When you go
– the shows were 30 minutes long.
If you go see Flag, it will kick your skull out because they're there to prove that they're Flag, and it's a special gig, and it might not happen again.
It's like an idealized Black Flag. And you're right, the Sabbath, like when we saw them in the late 90s, early 2000s, they were doing, it was like a best of set. It really was, you know, it was fantastic, no question. It was an idealized Black Sabbath set.
So I might argue that because at that time each of the musicians still had their core essence, that it might have been better than the average gig back. Maybe not as good as the best gig back in the day, but better than the average gig back in the day. But like now, you know, Ozzy is just shot. Bill Ward's not there. So my advice, if you haven't seen Sabbath, go just to get the most out of it you can. If you have seen Sabbath, then skip it. It's not, you know, that's my
advice. It's just so expensive, you know. I mean,
Ozzy just
how many cool local shows or good punk shows can you go to for the cost of $260 tickets and $10 beers and all that
plus $25 stuff, you know? Service charge.
Yeah, I've gotten very practical in my old age. I'd rather go see a band where I just can enjoy myself and, you know, have a couple of beers.
Ozzy just bums me out. He does so many bastardly things, you know what I mean? Like, you know, talking shit on Bill.
I think it's his wife, dude. I blame his wife.
I disagree with you entirely, Tom, and here's why.
She's the puppet master, John.
No, but listen to this. She's not the puppet master. Sharon is Ozzy's agent. Sharon works for Ozzy. And I mean this in a business context. I don't mean this in a gender relation context, obviously. I mean in a pure business context. If Ozzy didn't want Sharon to sue Tony Iommi when he had cancer, he would say, Sharon, you work for me. You may not sue Tony Iommi when he has cancer.
And she'd say, shut up, Ozzy.
Well, then he could say, well, then I'm getting divorced. Or he could say, then I'm firing you. You know, it's his,
who's going to change his diaper if not Sharon?
Well, he's a man. He can take care of himself. The point is this. People blaming Sharon for the dastardly deeds of Ozzy, I think, is a little sexist because she's just acting in her client's best interest, which is her job. You know, if it was a guy doing that, would people throw as much shade towards her? I don't think so. Maybe they would. But, the fact is, if Ozzy wanted the buck to stop with him, he could do it, and he doesn't. So Sharon is just saying, you're my client. I will make as much money for you as possible, which is her job. And Ozzy doesn't say stop. So I think it's purely Ozzy's fault. And that's why I lost a lot of respect for him over the past decade. The real kicker was when he sued Tony Iommi when he had cancer. I mean, come on. You know what I mean? But...
So the first time I saw Ozzy Osbourne, I've seen him solo a handful of times, never really because I wanted to, just, you know, free ticket here or go with friends there. First time I saw Ozzy Osbourne was his farewell tour, the year I graduated from high school, 1991. I saw Ozzy on his farewell tour. I've been out of school it'll be 25 years this summer. And that's how many years beyond his retirement he is. So.
I think this is the final Sabbath tour, though, because Tony Iommi was sick or is sick. No one's really clear. And Ozzy's pretty beat. I mean, Ozzy might tour again, but, you know. I think this is the last Sabbath tour. I do.
Yeah.
Can't outrun the Reaper, John, at some point.
A lot of people this year have proven that to be true, haven't they, Adam?
That's the truth.
The Reaper is having a grand year in 2016 so far.
Do we want to talk about a little bit about some of the other lineups that are playing this Hellfest? If you pull up the full poster for it, there's some really interesting groupings of bands, and there are some that strike me as really funny.
This is Europe, right? This is Europe. Yeah, Europe gets the craziest lineups.
So, I mean, the few that would probably be of the most interest to our listeners would be, I mean, there's the one day where you have, like, The Offspring and Dropkick Murphys, Turbo Negro, Hatebreed, that's all one show. But then you have weird, you have Sick of It All playing one day, but they're playing with Korn and Bring Me the Horizon. Like, that's, I don't know if that's exactly the word, you know.
And Bad Religion.
The Bad Religion's playing. The Bad Religion show has, like, the Toy Dolls playing it. The UK subs are playing it too. So
you're right. I'm reading this.
The European festivals have never drawn lines like that. I mean, there are some that are strictly metal, but they have always. It's like they don't have the genre upon genre splitting genres like we do here. You know, they have a lot of bands that are just rock and roll and that would never get on the radio here. Metal bands and punk bands play with each other. It's just, I don't know. Europe seems to have a different attitude about genres than we do.
There's your Melvins, John. They're playing the day with, what is it, Sun O? How do you say that band's name?
Like, if you're a drone guy, this is like a fantasy. I'm actually not really a drone guy, but Sun, the Melvins, Earth, and those are like the three big, well, Melvins aren't really drone, but Earth and Sun are like the drone champions. So that's a lot of drone music.
And the most important band on this whole thing, Foreigner.
Foreigner's playing?
Foreigner playing the one of the headlining the same headlining show that has Twisted Sister on it. You have
nice.
Foreigner and Joe Satriani.
Joe Satriani.
Foreigner is like the least authentic band at this point. It's only Mick Jones. That's it. Foreigner's only Mick Jones.
That same lineup, you have that Gutter Dameron film project, and Henry Rollins is playing that performance. So Henry Rollins and Foreigner, same bill.
Feels like the first time, guys.
Europe's great, man. Europe's great.
So anyways, John, you want to play us a song?
Listen, we've been speaking about whimsy a lot on this podcast. I'm going to play a song by Mike Love. It's not punk, but deal with it. Mike Love, of course, as you know, was in the Beach Boys. He's one of the main Beach Boys. It's Mike Love, Brian Wilson, and Dennis Wilson and Carl Wilson. They're kind of the main – oh, and the who's the short guy? It doesn't matter. Anyways – the 80s were rough for a lot of bands. For Queen, the 80s were rough. For Billy Joel, the 80s were rough. For Elton John, the 80s were really rough. For the Rolling Stones, kind of rough for the Rolling Stones. The only band that made it through the 80s, well, I mean, I'm not a Bruce Springsteen fan, but he did okay in the 80s for himself, you know? The 80s were rough. Mike Love put out his first solo album in 1981. This is a track from it. I'm not going to tell you anything about the track except for the track is called Rockin' the Little Man in the Boat. And keep in mind, this is by Mike Love of the Beach Boys doing Rockin' the Little Man in the Boat. And judge for yourself.
John, that was dirty, and we should have had a disclaimer.
I think the Dayglo Abortion should cover that, don't you think?
I should mention that. I should give credit. Jesse Townley brought that to my attention, but yeah, man, we need to take a shower after that. I mean, that almost rivals Shave 'Em Dry with Linda Bogdan.
Blowfly a couple weeks ago.
This is actually kind of dirtier than Blowfly because it's like Mike Love singing. Like when Blowfly sings, it's like, oh, there's a pervy old guy being pervy. But this is a guy that you don't expect to be pervy being pervy, which is pervier.
And the fact is, in 81, he wasn't that old.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know,
he was not a pervy old guy. He was a pervy approaching middle-aged guy.
He's just a perv.
Well, that's how
I can relate to that. A pervy approaching middle-aged guy.
That's how we're going to end the show tonight. Everybody's a perv, especially Tom. So
we started weak, but we rallied, guys.
This is the Punk News Podcast. If anyone wants to email us, it is podcast@punknews.org. We'll see you next week.